Good morning. You are listening to More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. Today is Monday, July 7th, 2007. If you are listening via the web, that's www.kboo.fm. 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in Columbia Gorge, and 100.7 in Willamette Valley. We greet you this morning. Celeste is away this morning, but I'm glad that you are here and joining us for this discussion this morning. This morning, we are talking about torture. This past weekend, the United States celebrated its anniversary of its independence, and among those qualities which we affirm throughout this past weekend is the nation's dedication towards the principles of liberty and justice for all. This morning we will examine how true we are to that founding principle and what things are happening within our society, within our nation, and within our world, and what things we can do to change and alter when we fall away from our high ideals. The focus of this morning's conversation is about torture, what it is, where does it happen, and what we can do about it. Joining me this morning is Kevin Finney with the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Also joining us is Dr. George Hunsinger, who is a professor at Princeton Theological Seminary, and he has written a book which is entitled Torture is a Moral Issue, Christian, Jews, Muslim, and People of Conscience Speak. He is also one of the founders of the National Coalition, Religious Coalition Against Torture, and he will be in Portland in July to lecture, and he will also be in Eugene and Bend. Joining us in a little bit is Dr. Darius Rijali, a professor at Reed College and the author of Torture and Democracy, an award-winning volume that examines torture and how it has influenced policies in democracy and in other governments. But this joining us right now is Kevin, and thank you for joining us, Kevin.
My pleasure to be here, Cecil.
I thought I would read a short piece from a statement that I believe that Ecumenical Ministries had signed on to in terms of torture. It's a statement of conscience from this national coalition, and it reads, in part, torture violates the basic dignity of the human person that all religions and their highest ideals hold dear. It degrades everyone's involved, policymakers, perpetrators, and victims. It contradicts our nation's most cherished ideals. Any policies that permit torture and inhumane treatment are shocking and morally intolerable. And it ends by saying nothing less is at stake in the torture abuse crisis than the soul of our nation. What does it signify if torture is condemned in word but allowed in deed? Let America abolish torture now without exceptions. Now, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon has been involved in this campaign against torture. Could you tell us something about first Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and this campaign that you are involved in?
Sure. Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon is a association of predominantly mainline Christian denominations, but also some interfaith organizations, individual congregations. We have direct service programs, an environmental ministries program, and our public policy program, which works primarily on poverty and social justice issues. We also have a peacemaking program, and together our peacemaking and public policy programs have been working on this issue of torture in conjunction with the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. And, you know, it was 1988 when Ronald Reagan signed the United Nations Convention Against Torture, and the U.S. Senate ratified it. And so the U.S. is a party to that international treaty, which forbids nations from engaging in torture for any purpose. And yet, as we've all seen in the last few years, we have been torturing people at Abu Ghraib, at Guantanamo, in hidden black sites in Europe and elsewhere that the CIA operates. And So I think it's inherent in our respect for the rule of law and our concern for human rights that people all over the country are really rising up to object to this. This religious coalition that's come together, it includes groups like Rabbis for Human Rights. There's an Evangelicals for Human Rights group, which is sponsoring a major conference on the topic in September in Atlanta. And really, all across the religious spectrum, folks are coming together to say torture is wrong. It not only degrades the people being tortured, it degrades us as a country and as individuals who engage in torture. And it's time to bring it to a stop.
And joining us at this time is Dr. George Hutzinger, who is the professor at Princeton Theological Seminary, and he will participate, be a keynote speaker at an event we'll talk about a little bit later. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Hutzinger.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, we appreciate your presence and ability to speak with us this morning. And also, we have Kevin Finney with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon here with us this morning. But perhaps I wanted to ask you at the beginning, in terms of the concept of torture, is something that people might be vaguely familiar with, but you've been instrumental in getting many people, many religious people involved in this issue. Could you tell us something, Dr. Hutzinger, about your initial involvement and why this is an important campaign that you have become involved in?
Yes, I think I can approach this from two different vantage points. First, and most immediately, when the Abu Ghraib photographs appeared, I had my doubts that it was just a bunch of rotten apples at the bottom of the barrel or Animal House on the night shift, as we were told that was the only thing at stake, that it was just happening at the lowest level and there was no responsibility higher up in the chain of command. But of course, I was also shocked and dismayed by the photographs themselves. And I kept waiting and hoping for some kind of outcry from the Christian churches and the larger, the other religious communities. But there really wasn't anything. And so about a year later, in the summer of 2005, I decided that, well, I'm only one person, but I will try to do what I can. And I began meeting with experts and making contacts with human rights groups. And that eventually led me to hold a conference here in Princeton, out of which the National Religious Campaign Against Torture was launched. But I had a long history of being concerned about the involvement of the United States government in torture. And I began asking myself, what did I know, and when did I know it? Well, I recently purchased a copy of Life magazine from July 17, 1970. I thought the article I remembered might be online. It wasn't, but there were references to it, and a website came up that sold old copies of Life magazine, so I bought it. But I was in seminary at that time, and I could remember reading a photo essay in that issue from July 1970 about tiger cages in Vietnam. It was an expose of how some prisoners were treated in an island off the coast of Vietnam in which there was abuse and effectively torture. And it left a lasting trace on my mind. And I guess I can say that reading that article, looking back, was the first step down a road that eventually led me to found the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. And I continued to read in this area off and on. And at one point in the 1980s and 90s, I served on the board of a small group, inconsequential, really called American Christians for the Abolition of Torture. And we disbanded after the Convention Against Torture was passed by the U.S. The U.N. Convention was ratified by the U.S., I think, in 1994. So I did have a history of concern and involvement in this area. I was active in the Central America Support Group movement in the 1980s, and we would hear about people who were being tortured, say, in El Salvador. We would sometimes meet them. So I didn't see the Abu Ghraib photographs in a vacuum. I had this history of concern. And then when there was just not much coming from the religious communities after Abu Ghraib, I felt something had to be done.
We're speaking this morning with Dr. George Huntinger of Princeton Theological Seminary, who has written and spoken out against torture, and Kevin Finney of the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. You mentioned Dr. Huntinger recalling, I think you used the term, when did you first hear about it or knew about torture, and referred to a July 1970 Life magazine article. You also mentioned that you were concerned because voices weren't, religious voices were not speaking up after the Abu Ghraib incidents came to public attention. Why were so many voices silent, especially if, especially considering the history? This isn't something new. Why do you think initially religious voices were silent in recent years around torture?
Well, that's a very good question. I wish I knew the answer to it. It's the question that spurred me into action, you might say. But I think the large national religious organizations have a big agenda and a small budget, and they weren't necessarily able to put much staff work and energy into this question. I mean, statements were made and so on, but they didn't really make much of an impression in the public discussion. I think at that time, Americans in general, and including religious people, may have been still in a state of shock and denial about what was happening after the United States invasion of Iraq. I think there was a certain amount of fear. There was a certain amount of resentment and anger. There is prejudice against Arabs and Muslims, which is something that the National Religious Campaign Against Torture also strives to counteract along with our work against torture. So it's a complex matter. I think it was difficult for many people to believe that there might really have been serious involvement of people higher up the chain of command that would have been behind the abuses that we saw in the Abu Ghraib photographs. And I think now, 3 years later, from the time that I started working on this pretty much as a second full-time job, Americans are in a different place, and it's becoming more and more evident. The evidence is becoming more and more unavoidable that these terrible abuses had their origins at the very, very highest levels of the United States government. Indeed, that they go all the way into the office of the Secretary of Defense, the Vice President of the United States, and even the Oval Office itself.
Once Americans and religious people were able to break themselves out of denial, people such as yourself, Dr. Huntinger, were able to begin organizing people, communities across the nation. And here in Oregon, the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and other groups have taken on the clarion call to speak out against torture, and you will be coming to Oregon later this month. And I wanted Kevin to speak a little about how Ecumenical Ministries became involved in this work and about the programs that you will sponsor later this month.
Sure. Well, we initially got involved at the end of last year when we were contacted by the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, and they explained that there was an upcoming vote in the Senate on an intelligence authorization bill that included a provision that would basically ban the CIA from engaging in torture by forcing them to comply with the interrogation standards of the Army Field Manual. And they wanted us to get some messages of support for that into our U.S. senators, especially Senator Gordon Smith. And so we embarked on that. We circulated a sign-on letter that over 175 clergy and other religious leaders in Oregon signed and submitted to Senator Smith. We did a conference call with his key aide on this issue in Washington, D.C., and kind of went from there. As our work went forward, we wanted to work on expanding a broader network of both religious and secular activists to oppose the use of torture here in Oregon. And as part of that, we've arranged for this conference on Wednesday, July 23rd, titled The Ethics of Torture and Human Rights. George Hunsinger, our guest today, is the keynote speaker there. We also have a number of other interesting speakers. J. David Kenzie, who is the director of the Torture Treatment Victims Center up at OHSU, and he's a psychiatrist who specializes in treating trauma. And Stephen T. Wax, who's the chief defender for the Federal Public Defender's Office here, has a new book out about his efforts to obtain access to the courts for Guantanamo detainees called When Kafka Comes to America. Allison Brisk, who's a professor at University of California, Irvine, and has authored or edited about six books on human rights, and a number of other really impressive speakers. I think it'll be a really interesting day of discussion about these issues looked at from a variety of both religious and secular perspectives. And we encourage members of the public to go to our website at www.emoregon.org and download the materials, or just Google Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon.
And also, you'll have the pleasure of accompanying Dr. Hunsinger throughout Oregon in Eugene and Bend. Is that correct?
Yes. When my directors, when we had arranged for Dr. Hunsinger to come out for the conference, my executive director came in and said, why don't we ask him if he'll also go to Bend and Eugene? And I said, oh, my gosh, we just got him to agree to come to Portland. Do I have to now go back to him and ask him? But to Dr. Hunsinger's credit, he was actually excited to do it, was really glad to have the opportunity to speak in more places here in Oregon. And so we have the opportunity to get him out around the state, and we're very excited about that.
Excellent. You're listening to KBOO FM 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Columbia Gorge, 100.7 in Willamette Valley. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. Our guest at this present is Dr. George Hunsinger, professor at Princeton Theological Seminary, and Kevin Finney of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Dr. Hunsinger, I wanted to ask you in terms of your organizing churches, and you mentioned in terms of people not wanting to believe that torture, those responsible, it reached to the highest levels in government, and we were in sort of a denial. And oftentimes when we have conversations around not only this topic but other topics, it becomes sort of a political debate. I think part of the work you have done is to move it. Certainly, it is a political debate, but you believe that torture in and of itself is deeper than political partisanship, and it is against the deeply held traditions of most Americans. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. My own personal concern about torture is one that goes back far enough that it's been a matter of Democratic and Republican administrations. It's not a partisan issue. That's what we mean when we say in the National Religious Campaign Against Torture that torture is a moral issue. This is beyond partisan politics, and we have a statement of conscience that people could read and sign if they wanted to, if they wanted to go to the NRCAT website, nrcat.org. They could read the statement of conscience and add their names if they wish, and you will see that we have very prominent people who have signed from both sides of the political aisle, you might say. When I first started organizing on this, you know, I met a certain amount of resistance because people felt that this initiative was directed against the Bush administration primarily, and it isn't. And we were able to convince them that it wouldn't matter what party was in power, it wouldn't matter who was running the administration. Torture is just intolerable, it's immoral, it's against the law, international law and domestic law. It's against everything that America stands for, and we need to organize and mobilize to do what we can to bring this great national shame to an end.
As you speak to different congregations and different communities, and are people taking on, becoming aware and also organizing in the community? And maybe I should direct this to Kevin, because I know of a campaign in which I think religious congregations are urged to have a banner in front of their places of worship. Could you tell us something about that?
Yeah, and I think Dr. Hunsinger could too. That's a banner campaign that was initiated by the National Religious Campaign Against Torture called Banners Across America, and which they urged congregations to order a banner making a statement that torture is morally wrong or something similar. And we've got something like 26 churches here in Oregon that have done that, and there are churches in every state of the nation that have put these banners up. And I think it's been a pretty successful effort both to raise the visibility of this issue within the faith community, but also to get press coverage and raise it within the broader community as well.
And Dr. Hutzinger, this is a campaign that's nationwide, is that correct?
Yes, it is. As Kevin mentioned, we succeeded in finding churches and religious communities that put up the banner in the month of June in all 50 states of the Union. I think in the end it was about 350 congregations and related groups altogether. This is a big step forward to us. People need to realize, of course, that the National Religious Campaign Against Torture is a very young organization. We're not like Amnesty International or some of the other big human rights groups. So given the fact that we just got started and, in fact, we haven't had the funding mm-hmm. for a full-time staff and an executive director, for much more than a year, and since, for about 2.5 years, almost 3 years now, it was primarily two or three people, including myself, who took this project on as a second full-time job mm-hmm. until we got the funding to actually get our organization off the ground. So this is a startup organization, and the response we've gotten shows, I think, that another reason why there wasn't that outcry at the beginning after the Abu Ghraib photographs appeared was that there was not any organized leadership, and people were waiting for some leadership. They were waiting for some educational materials and events, and we've been able to provide that, and we're striding forward. It's really very moving to me and encouraging to me that 3 years later, from dating it from the summer of 2005, when nothing existed, we have grown to this point.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil, without Celeste this morning. We're speaking about torture this morning. We mentioned as we began our program this morning that this past weekend the United States celebrated the anniversary of its independence and celebration of its highest ideals. We have discovered, which is perhaps not something new, but are aware of that we often fall far short of our ideals. Joining us is someone who has certainly enlightened many of us, and we are glad that Dr. Darius Rajali, who is the author of Torture and Democracy, is joining us this morning. And let me just say that this book, which is a monumental work, has recently won the 2007 Human Rights Book Award from the American Political Science Association unanimously. And this award is decided on the merits of the book's scholarship and for its capacity to influence policy or bring about change in human rights conventions. So thank you very much for joining us this morning.
It's nice to be here.
And it's good that you're not on jury duty. Is that you?
That's true. I did my duty last week.
Okay. You know, some of us want to know how we can get out of it, but I guess you had to actually.
Well, I think all of us, whether we're academics or not, need to do our public service.
Okay. Well, thank you for doing the public service and joining us this morning. Perhaps we would like to begin by telling us something about the premise of your book, Torture and Democracy, and why it's in such an important volume.
Sure. I mean, most people don't, at least when I started writing the book, never thought that democracy and torture had any connection to each other. After all, Democrats are opposed to torture, that people don't like being tortured, so they won't elect people who will torture them, right? Mm-hmm. And or, you know, politicians kind of have a gentleman's agreement, you don't torture us, we don't torture you. So democracies typically won't have torture, whereas authoritarian states will. But that's actually not the historical pattern. The historical pattern is that democracies actually, even our most ancient ones, Greek, Roman, Venetian republics, they all have torture. In various forms, sometimes with full approval, sometimes implicitly. The French, the British, the Americans, all tortured, even before World War II. These are pretty well-documented cases. In many cases, it was standard operating procedure in colonies and in the American South, various places. So the premise of my book was basically, where is the demand for torture coming from in democracies, and where's the supply? And it takes about 880 pages to figure that one out. And then I had to turn around and answer the other question, which all of a sudden became so important from a policy standpoint, which is, does it work? And that added another extra chapter, I think 5 chapters.
Mm-hmm.
So it tries to be as thorough as possible. It's designed to be a source book.
And speaking, the title itself might cause some people to raise their eyes because they say torture and democracy, and they would naturally think that democracy by its nature is opposed to torture. But you've written that that's not necessarily the case, and talk about the,
sure,
the differences between torture and democracy and other regimes.
Well, I mean, first of all, let's be clear. Authoritarian states really deserve their reputation for torture and violence. I mean, they are nasty pieces of work, and the democratic record is nowhere near as bad as, say, fascist Germany or Stalinist Russia. That said, it's not that there's been no history of torture in democracies. It's just a different history. And I think we could kind of look at it from two sides. On the one hand, on the demand side, most people tend to think, well, torture happens in democracies because, well, there's a national emergency and there's some ticking time bomb somewhere and people have to do these things. In fact, that really only accounts for about a third of the cases I look at. Torture happens in democracies for at least 3 other reasons. That's the demand sometimes comes from local communities, local police in combination with businessmen and property owners. Let police torture for confessions. This, of course, happened famously in Chicago between 73 and 1993 and has brought about huge multimillion dollar suits against the city because it turns out that there are even men on death row whose confessions were coerced. That's really common. It's also common in, say, South America, Rio, or in the new democracies like Russia. Another way in which torture enters into democracies is with judicial systems that are really imperfect. Not all judicial systems are the same, and there's some judicial systems that value confessions far more. And whenever a judge values confession or juries value confessions, police will get it for you any way they can. In Japan, for example, the Japanese Bar Association found numerous cases of torture. And in part, this is part of the Japanese system, which overvalues confessions. So it can happen for a variety of reasons. The last reason that it can happen is that soldiers returning from war often bring torture back with them. If they got ahead as an MP doing torture abroad, I mean, think about this, what kind of job you think you're going to get when you come back stateside. And what happens often, both in the United States after two wars where we tortured the Spanish-American-Philippine Insurgency War and Vietnam, is we found cases where soldiers returning from war brought torture to a neighborhood near you. Mm-hmm. And that also, we're not special that way. I mean, I'm a social scientist, so I count the cases, but the French went through this. There are a number of other cases. This is nothing particular to us. But these are the ways in which torture comes into democracies.
We're speaking this morning about torture. Our guests include Kevin Finney of the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, Dr. George Huttinger of Princeton Theological Seminary, and Dr. Darius Rajali of Reed College. If you have a question or a comment to share with our guests, give us a call at 503-231-8187. It occurred to me we've been speaking for about a half an hour about torture, but we have not yet defined it. Now, that in and of itself might be up to debate. I thought I'd read something, a comment that if some government official, if the person dies, then it's torture. Dr. Huttinger, how would you define torture, or is there a consensus?
Sure. Let me say first that I'm honored to be in the same program with Dr. Rajali, and I hope the people of Oregon understand what a treasure they have in Portland. I hope that Dr. Rajali gets as much exposure as he can. His book is quite simply the most authoritative study of torture that has ever been written, and I'm sure that he could give a better answer to your question than I could, and most of what I've learned about torture I've learned from him.
Oh, but George,
anyway.
You're so good at it. You should continue.
But,
good at torture?
Good at speaking.
Okay. Yeah, look, it's not a matter of personal opinion. There are people who try to hide behind what I call the vagueness defense. They say, well, these terms are vague, and we have to specify what we mean, and we don't know what torture is. The laws against torture are specific enough, and we know what torture involves. And the standard definition is something like this, that torture inflicts excruciating pain, whether mental or physical, by a government on a victim for certain purposes. Dr. Rajali mentioned the confession. We're aware of interrogation. Torture is sometimes actually used. This is not a part of standard definitions, but it works out this way. Torture is sometimes used as a form of terrorism to strike fear in the hearts of the population or of the targeted group. like communists, for example, or Jews or African Americans in the United States or whatever. So torture has various purposes, but the definition is that a government inflicts excruciating pain, whether mental or physical, on a victim for some governmental purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I can broaden that. I think George is right. I mean, from my point of view, basically there are four characteristics. There's you need a government official or someone designated as a government official, say a death squad person or someone.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be the person has to be helpless. That is, the person has to be detained, unable to move, unable to escape. So that distinguishes it, say, from police brutality or anything that happens on the street.
Mm-hmm.
The person is subjected to excruciating pain, physical or mental. The United Nations definition includes mental and physical. And lastly, the purposes for which it's put are not private purposes, but public purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Either a forced confession, information, or intimidation, as Dr. Hunsinger said. These are important elements of the concept of torture for a long, long time. And I guess a couple of other points are in order about the vagueness defense. You know, there are certain elements of this that are obviously going to be vague. Pain is a kind of hard thing to identify.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important to recognize that there are certain things in life that are just so terrible that we shouldn't go near them. I mean, for example, you know, in case of sexual harassment, for example, we would think that something weird about a boss who would say, just a little sexual harassment. Could you define that for me? I mean, is that touching or is that not? We think someone's like that really weird and sick. And the same thing with torture. When people really want to define it, pin it down, you kind of wonder whether they really want to do it or not, you know? I mean, that's really what's going on behind trying to get it more precise. And in fact, that is more or less what happened with the Military Commissions Act. It defined torture in such a way that 90% of what we would ever and had ever been qualified as torture under United Nations things rules would not be characterized as torture. And what is more, I think this is important to recognize, the Military Commissions Act of 2006 allowed for parallel systems where the military can't torture even by its own definition,
mm-hmm.
and the CIA can. And that is a very serious problem because whenever you have two-track systems, torture bleeds across the line. It's only a matter of time before an interrogator says, why should I be stuck using Class B techniques when those guys can use the really good stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it corrupts the army fairly quickly. We saw this in Brazil in particular, where eventually the military had to shoot its own torturers and raid its own camps because military discipline was falling apart. And it's one of, you know, again, it's one of the characteristic features of torture that once it's institutionalized in a military structure or in an intelligence structure, the intelligence unit becomes much less responsive to control by government authority. So it's no real surprise, for example, that the CIA destroys videotapes of Abu Zubaydah or any other stuff, because that could have been entirely predicted from all the other cases. By the way, and this isn't just us. Authoritarian states have this too. You know, the Gestapo just swung so fast out of control that, you know, by 1942, different Gestapos were doing different things and fairly unresponsive to Hitler's command. Now, if someone like that can control their Secret Service, what's our situation?
Kevin, earlier you mentioned about a letter that was sent to Senator Smith, and as the two professors were speaking in terms of defining torture and, mm-hmm. and CIA versus the Army Field Manual. Currently, do you know the status in terms of legislation in terms of torture?
Well, on that particular vote, the prohibition on torture that was in the bill did remain in the bill, and it passed in the Senate. So it passed both houses of Congress. And however, President Bush did veto it, and so it has not yet taken effect. Now, there's a another vote coming up this summer on an attempt to apply the require all U.S. held detainees to be revealed to the International Committee of the Red Cross, and to allow the International Committee of the Red Cross to have access to those detainees, which would be a very important step in making sure that they're being treated with a modicum of human decency. So that's really the next vote. I don't remember the exact timing, but I think we're expecting something later this month on that. And it would be great if folks wanted to contact their senators and House members and urge them to support that effort.
Great, great. And before we go to a couple of callers, I just wanted to ask Professor Rajali, you mentioned in your comments about just had a brain freeze. when we were talking about defining torture, and you also mentioned the philosophical opposition to it, but also I think you mentioned whether the utilitarian principle. So does torture work? The argument you might hear is we're under a state of attack, and we need to get information because a bomb might go off this afternoon.
Yeah. No, it's true. Well, I mean, I'm not surprised that your brain freezes. Everybody's brain freezes when it comes to torture. You can't kind of believe people are doing what they're doing. And you very rapidly develop a dislike for human beings fairly rapidly because people can be so stupid. As my father's wont of saying, he says, God put a limit on intelligence but no limit on stupidity. But obviously this is a very serious question. And on this question, I think torture and democracy, I don't care whether you call this stuff torture, not torture, tough stuff, muffin stuff. It just doesn't matter to me. It's really the only question on the utilitarian standard is, does it work? What is its results and what are its effects? And basically, its results are fairly clear, which is that it's probably the clumsiest method you could use. And I'm quoting here the Japanese World War II manual of the fascist Kempei Tai. So this is from their interrogation manual. And the Gestapo knew this too. July 21st, 2005, a bunch of guys get on British buses carrying bombs packed with nails. Bombs don't explode, thankfully. They escape. There's one ticking time bomb. It's thrown into the bushes. The British police catch all these guys within a week, including the ticking time bomb. And these guys have all been convicted now in England. They did this without torture, under extremely constrained time situations. And they did this by the book, the way most police know it should be done, which is through the use of public cooperation. When you don't have public cooperation, basically your chances of finding the ticking time bomb go down to less than 10%. And this is not like a mysterious piece of knowledge. This has been confirmed by a lot of different sources, and the Gestapo knew this too. If I can give another example. Mm-hmm. In 1943, the head of Czechoslovakia's, the Reichsprotector of Czechoslovakia, was assassinated by the resistance. The Gestapo basically found the killers. They found it by torturing something like 7,545 individuals, out of which for the three that they got, including 100 resistance people that they didn't mean to get, but it was a huge dragoon. It went through thousands and thousands of people. But it's important to recognize that the break in the case came when Henrik von Panowitz, who was the chief Gestapo anti-sabotage unit, showed up in Czechoslovakia, and he said, look, this is stupid. All the policing research tells you that you need to depend on public cooperation. They got 1,000 tips, and the real break in the case came when a member of the resistance, a man by the name of Kurda, walked in and handed over the safe church where these people were hidden. And Kurda survived. He got a big award. He lived long enough to be shot after the war for treason. Mm. And it's important to recognize that this was knowledge that has long been known. Same thing with July 21st. The key break in July 21st was when the mothers of Mokhtar Saeed Ibrahim saw his picture on the ITV film and called him in and told the police, this was my son, this is where you can find him. And the question is, would a British Muslim, loyal British Muslims, turn in their own children if they knew they were going to be tortured? I mean, torture doesn't not only not work, I mean, the rate of torture is about 20 to 78 innocents for each accurate hit, depending on the statistical cases where we're looking at. Not only does it really have an incredibly lousy return compared to any other kind of policing strategy, especially in wartime situations, but it undermines the very thing that we need to win the war on terror, which is public cooperation and the willingness of communities to assist us. The more we torture, the more we undermine ourselves. The other way to respond to the utilitarian argument, frankly, is quite simple. I don't know how many lives torture has saved, but what I can tell you is this, that I know how many lives torture has taken. Because much of the intelligence that led us into this war was, you know, came from coerced intelligence. Much of the intelligence, like, for example, the torture of Yusuf Sheikh al-Libi, who was the one who told us that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction and al-Qaeda was working with him. We now know this was false. I think it's important to recognize that we may not, whatever that number is that pro-torture proponents have, it better be a darn big one. Because the number of lives that torture has taken is extraordinary.
You're listening this morning to More Talk Radio. Our guests this morning are Dr. Darius Rajali, author of the award-winning and very important book, Torture and Democracy. Dr. George Hussinger, professor of theology at Princeton Theological Seminary and the author of Torture is a Moral Issue, Christian Jews, Muslim, and People of Conscience Speak, and Kevin Finney with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, which is sponsoring an interfaith forum on the ethics of torture and human rights later this month. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Please give us a call if you have a question or comment for our guests. And we'll go to John. Good morning, John. John, you're on the air. John is waiting. Okay, maybe John has disappeared. Do we have another caller? Yes, we do. So we'll go to our next caller.
Hello?
Yes, good morning.
Yes, hello. Yes, thank you. Seriously, thank you for this uncomfortable program. seriously, we need it. I'm a mother and a grandmother. I don't have degrees. I haven't done anything that I guess people respect in general. But, you know, I've acquired a lot of wisdom about life. And I realize that sometime anybody coming back from war is going to come back and probably create unhealthy energy in their countries, whether it's domestic violence, rape, whatever. But, you know what, I have another awareness. You know, in this country, maybe in the world, we have a lot of psychological and mental and physical abuse in this country in our families, in prisons, and at workplace, at schools, and that. And, you know, that needs to be addressed, too, but I guess it never will be the way things are happening. But I do appreciate this program. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if I could add on to that, I mean, I think a very big part of torture and democracy, noise somewhere.
Okay.
There's a very big part of torture and democracy which tries to show not just the demand side but the supply side. Where do torture techniques come from? And one of the important things to recognize is, in fact, as the caller says, when torture is disapproved by governments, it tends to hide out. And it hides out in homes, in fraternities, in schools. One of my I think my editor, it was, when he was reading a draft of the book, came across a section of the book entitled where I talk about the New York Police using a particular method of choking called the necktie, where they adjust your tie to the point that you turn blue in the face, and they're just, you know, cleaning you up, right? And he was like, oh, my Lord, this is what, you know, Clive Stewart Smith did to me, when I was in boarding school in Canada. And I was like, yeah, well, you know, where do you think that stuff goes? You know, it goes in the movies and then disappears we know how there's a kind of circular channel of this stuff. This torture doesn't just hide in like some box in the CIA where people quietly go out and open it up and let it out. It's there in army training camps. It's there in hazing rituals. It's there in all forms of domestic violence. So it's one of the really difficult things to do, and this is what Torture and Democracy tries to do very carefully, is to map the chain, the way in which one person passes a technique on to another historically. But I think the speaker is correct that a big part, we'll never quite be able to get rid of all violence in our society, and it's always going to take human vigilance to control violence, and that's true not just of government but of our society as well.
As we maintain continued vigilance, we also have to be observant of our own history and our own collaboration with torture. And I thought I might ask Dr. Hussinger, in terms of not necessarily the history of torture, but in terms of the religious community's understanding. Certainly the religious communities have participated and have been the recipient of torture. Is torture in and of itself part of religion, or have we changed our understanding of human rights?
Well, I think there have been significant changes in recent history. And yes, religious communities have a lot to confess and repent of. You know, in working on an interreligious basis, I find that when the Jewish community thinks about torture, one of the first things that comes up for them is the Inquisition. You know, and how could it be otherwise? Sure, I mean, the churches have something in their past to be ashamed of, and that we need to confess and move on and try to take a more humane and consistent stand than we have in the past. And I would imagine that all religious communities have aspects of their past that need to be faced for what they are and repented of. But today, certainly in the United States, this is not a divisive issue among the major religions, and that's how the National Religious Campaign Against Torture has been able to bring Muslims and Jews together, and evangelicals and Catholics and mainline Protestants, and whatever other disagreements or differences in viewpoint we might have among us, we're all very clear that torture is a moral issue, that it's intolerable, and that we need to do what we can to bring our government's complicity in it to an end.
And we'll go to our next caller. We have a caller on the line. And good morning, caller. Thank you for your patience.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I see torture kind of along the same, at least in this new American narrative, is along the same lines as what happened after 9/11. The message that we sent to terrorists was, if you want to completely destroy our way of life, if you want to gut our Constitution and stomp all over American values, all you have to do is take down a building. That's it. Take down a building and you've won the war. And I appreciate the hard work that you put into this book. And I know there are a lot of intellectuals out there who would agree with you, but intellectualizing this situation, I think, is harmful. Because the people who extol the virtues of torture know all of your intellectual arguments. They're insane. You cannot reason with these people. Maybe they need to experience it themselves before they go around talking about ripping fingernails out.
Thank you.
You know, you can't reason with insane people. It's true. That being said, I have spent a lot of time actually talking to military, police, and FBI people who actually agree with everything I say and have fought the good fight within the government and have tried very hard to preserve our values. I think what you're saying is correct, which is that the war on terror isn't
a war that is about winning more land or more wealth or more booty. It's ultimately a war without territory. It's a war about values. And, you know, the ultimate question that has to come down to us is, if we torture, what remains of our values? And I think that's correct. And I think there are many people, both in the military and in the government, who actually agree with you on this point. And they have been fighting the good fight, and they've been pretty much fighting it alone, without the support of the American public or without the kinds of social campaign work that's been done. You know, one of the interesting things after 2004 was I kept on thinking, why is this not like France? France had a situation just like this in the 1950s, and out of the blue came this massive anti-torture movement that was led on the one hand by right-wing evangelical Catholics and on the other hand by the left. And in the United States, I just kept on waiting, and I kept on waiting. And, you know, it's nice to see that it's happening finally. But what has happened, what happened in France, which was which led eventually to a huge transformation in French public consciousness and also eventually in England led to Amnesty International, has been slow here. And that's really kind of surprising because, you know, the truth is that Americans have been polled since 9/11. Numerous polls have shown repeatedly that the support for torture is always less than the majority. It's usually between 35 and 45% of the American public. Consistently, American public, no matter how you've posed the ticking time bomb example or any of these other things, the American public has been opposed to it, 55 to 65%. The latest poll that just came out, I think, had a number of about 55%. So, you know, the truth is that the American sort of moral universe is fairly intact. Actually, the Pew Charitable Trust argument also, their polling shows that approval of torture is somewhat higher in religious communities than it is in secular communities, with Catholics kind of just being over 50% and secular ones being at about 30%. So it's a kind of odd distribution. We have a lot to learn about where things are. But I think you're right. I mean, I think the ultimate question, and this is the question that I pose to my opponents when I debate them in Washington or anywhere, is it better to be loved or is it better to be feared? You might think that it would be better to be feared and you don't care because you want these people gone. But actually, as I remind them, my great-grandfather was a prince. He also wanted to be feared, and he had no trouble torturing any of his opponents who he called terrorists and anarchists. And no one misses his way of life at all. No one mourns his passing, and no one will mourn our passing either if we continue down this road. And this actually does penetrate. I assure you, it does penetrate. Because I think the real answer to whether it is better to be loved or feared is simply that if you can fight with one hand behind your back and win, you will be both loved and feared, and you will be deeply respected. And that's really the problem, is that we've forgotten. That's the American way.
Let's go to our next caller. Good morning, caller, and thank you for your patience. Michael, thank you.
Good morning. Sir, I just want to ask, by writing your book, what do you hope to gain? It seems like that during this administration, a lot of books have been written, a lot of authors have been produced, but nothing has changed. This president is above the law, and it seems like him and his crew is going to walk away untouched, and that this generation will go down in history as a do-nothing generation.
Mm. You know, that's probably true in the sense that I doubt if the president or any of these people will eventually come to trial. I think that's probably true. Maybe some of the lawyers at the Pentagon or so forth might be called to answer for some of these things. But so, I think you're right.
So while right, so that's what I'm saying. The only thing that I've seen anybody do during this administration just write books, analyze, and critique. But other than that, you know, nothing is happening. And it's almost like I wish that the American society was made up of gangsters, because at least gangsters don't believe that there's anybody in the world that's untouchable. So it seemed like to me that if everybody had a gangster mentality, we'd have been there and got them guys out of office. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I guess I would put it this way. The reason to write this book is that torture isn't just something attached to a single administration. The fact that torture happened isn't just because George Bush decided to wake up one day and say, okay, let's do this. I mean, maybe he did. But the point is that these techniques survive in our society. They survive. They were already there. They're in your neighborhood. They're in your schools. They're in your families. If you can't deal with those things locally, why should the nation be able to deal with them publicly? We have a lot of house cleaning to do. America is not an entirely peaceful society. There's lots of violence. The other point to recognize is that not only are the causes of torture much more complicated than a single person or a single administration, but the effects of torture are also incredibly complicated. Anybody who thinks that by changing presidents, a President Obama is going to change things, you need to think about four things that the book, I think, pretty clearly lays out. Mm-hmm. The first is that there was a war within this administration between professionals and people who supported torture, and the professionals left. Many of the people I know who are honorable and decent people, military lawyers, FBI counterterrorism specialists, have left. Ask yourself who's left behind in the CIA. Is someone really going to replace all these people? Mm-hmm. Secondly, the hospitals are full of people who have been, you know, traumatized through perpetration of atrocities. Veterans hospitals need to address these things. America is neither willing to acknowledge or pay, frankly, for the treatment of these people, and that needs to happen. Again, where are we and why aren't we talking about this? Lastly, well, actually two other things. Anybody who was a whistleblower in this administration, including Specialist Darby, who revealed Abu Ghraib, has been hiding because they're terrified of the way the public attacks them. Not the administration, the public, right? And it's important to recognize that the whistleblower law is broken, and we can't protect fraud ourselves from fraud, much less from human rights violations, if we can't fix the whistleblower laws. So these are three things that are going to survive regardless. George Bush has revealed them to us, but they were there. It means that the United States has a lot of work to do, and you know everybody has a lot of work to do in their neighborhoods as well.
Dr. Hutzinger, are you still there?
Yes.
I know you agreed to stay until about 8:40, and so I wanted to honor that commitment. But before we have to let you go, I was wondering in terms of your reflection in terms of how to change our attitude or towards torture. It seems as if, listening in this conversation, that part of the work that we need to do is to wake up to the reality that torture takes place in what we think is an open democratic society. What do you think in terms of how might the religious community change the consciousness, help change the consciousness and motivate people in this country to speak out loudly and clearly against torture?
Well, it is my hope that the National Religious Campaign Against Torture can be successful in helping to provide a grassroots movement against torture and for human rights by working with people in the pews and the religious communities. Take the Roman Catholic community, for example, that Dr. Rajali mentioned. The Vatican position on torture, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops position on torture is uncompromising. Torture is never justified. And for the Catholics, that is today an exceptionless moral rule. And yet many Roman Catholics in the pews either don't share that view or don't understand it. We have just finished in the National Religious Campaign a project that will provide study materials now, working through the U.S. Conference of Catholic bishops that can be used and will be used in Roman Catholic communities. So that's an example of the kind of educational effort that we are sponsoring. Something similar has happened among the evangelicals. And as you mentioned, we now have many evangelicals and the National Association of Evangelicals, the major evangelical national organization, is on record as being against torture. And the younger evangelicals, especially people whose names are not as well known as some of the more prominent ones, are deeply concerned about this matter and ready to act on it. So, yeah, it will take time, but I believe in the long run we will be able to succeed in creating that kind of base. And like Dr. Rajali, I am kind of perplexed that we don't see more people rising up as they did in France to mobilize around this question. But I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to see a lot more action in this area than we have so far.
Thank you so much. Dr. Rajali, did you want to add?
And I think it's important to recognize that the future is actually brighter than we might think. We have a history in the United States where when these crises have come and they have come to public consciousness, we have been able to clean up our act quite well. It doesn't really take a great deal of effort to stop torture, really. It really takes clear leadership and clear principles. That's all it really takes. I mean, I could get into the social psychology of it, but most torture isn't done by people who are abnormal or sadomasochistic or something like this. Mm-hmm. It's done by organizations that create conditions that encourage normal people like you and me to do it. And all of us, put in the right circumstance, might consider torturing someone. 70% of us, according to the data, will. But it's important to recognize that you can say no, even in those circumstances. 30% do. And I think the other part of this is to recognize is that in the United States, we had horrible police conditions in the early 20th century. From 1910 to 1930, torture was pretty routine in most American police precincts. And it was in the 1930s, led by the Supreme Court and legal associations and various journalists and various other people who actually wrote to the public and told them what to do, that between 30 and 45, more or less, we cleaned up our act. Police stations, now when torture happens, that happens in Chicago or occasionally in New Orleans or places like this, it is off the charts. It really stands as an exception to standard American policing, whereas easily 60 years ago, no one could have said this. It's important to recognize that we've done this before. Yeah, it's a mess, but we can clean it up. We did it before.
And Kevin, do you have a
question? I just want to add here, you know, in response to this notion that the American public kind of supports torture, public opinion polls show that. But I see the same thing when I go from church to church holding dialogues about this issue, that there's always some members of the congregation who say, look, this is a harsh world. You know, we have to be able to engage in these kind of tactics. These terrorists, they're not aligned with any particular state. They're not subject to international law. Isn't it okay for us to do this? But I think when you get into a dialogue about the issues and you point out that pragmatically torture doesn't really work in most cases as the best method of gaining intelligence, that once you begin to allow torture for those exceptional circumstances, it has a tendency to spread. And most particularly, when you remind people of to just be a little bit scriptural here, when you remind people of the notion of the golden rule, that you should do unto others as you want them to do unto you, and that, you know, we protested very loudly when our military personnel were being tortured during World War II and in other situations, that once we begin to engage in torture, then the rest of the world, the rogue states, if you will, that want to engage in torture have a license to say, well, the U.S. is doing it. Why shouldn't we be allowed to do it? People begin to get a different perspective on this. So I think the dialogue is an important one to have. And I think us being able to set a standard in terms of human rights treaties, in terms of the rule of law, in terms of saying we're not going to do it and we expect other nations not to. Ultimately, if we wanted to defeat terrorism, it's going to be much more important that we combat the underlying causes of terrorism, the lack of the extreme poverty in the world, the failed states that are dissolving and leading to this kind of internecine battles. Engaging in the world in a positive way will do a lot more to undermine terrorism than ever engaging in torture will.
We have a few minutes left and a couple of callers, so let's try to get our callers' comments or questions in. Let's go to our next caller. Thank you for waiting.
Thank you, Cecil. I hope my call isn't torture. The most horrible thing I've heard come out of the government rule so far is, if the prisoner dies, you're not doing it right. That apparently applies to Khaki and Three Canopy or whatever these Titan and all these private contractors, as well as the CIA in theater over there now. But I really am glad you've got your guests on for talking about the religious and social aspects of this religious community. Famously Roman Catholic Mel Gibson, for instance, with his expensive snuff film that he called The Passion of the Christ, sold out theaters in all of Christendom, all around the world, to great acclaim, even though it was even subtitled in English, but spoken in Aramaic, apparently. And I'm wondering if Christians and if religious people generally, when they hear the word waterboarding, they think it's surfboarding. Well, waterboarding is actually controlled drowning, not simulated drowning, but controlled drowning. And I'm wondering also if these... you spoke obviously of men and women in the military coming back in our filling our police forces, but now the boys who torture small animals are going into the CIA, and if torture to some of these is not mere sadism, and except again if the frog dies, you're not doing it right, needs to apply, I guess. Maybe the torturers are finding other ways of becoming filling our society. And finally, the real question is, what is the religious community doing itself with the teaching of boys? Because this is where it begins. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you
again, thank you very much.
Well, just quickly, some points of fact, and I'll pass it on to Kevin or George, who would take on the religious component. It is indeed, has always been the rule in torture that if your prisoner dies, you're not doing it right. That's been true forever because basically that's murder as opposed to torture. There's a fairly clear line. The victim either has to confess or he has to be intimidated, whatever else, he's got to walk out of the room. So I think that's true. I'm not surprised. Again, I feel like that rule is as old as the hills. The other part of this is that actually, most organizations weed out their sadists. The problem with sadists and little boys who torture things is that they don't listen to rules. And organizations are all about rules. Mm-hmm. Terrorist organizations don't take on sadists. They profile for the most normal personality possible. Likewise, the CIA profiles very carefully for the most normal personalities possible. So I don't think there is a sharp connection. As I say, sadists normally get identified early and drummed out of the system, and anyone who finds these people knows that, even if you interview torturers, they will tell you that they don't like sadists. I mean, we have this in writing from, of all places, the Tuol Sleng interrogation manual in Cambodia, which really rails against sadists and wants disciplined, organized, normal people. I think it's really important to recognize that all of us are potentially capable of evil. And the reason that Democrats prefer democracy as opposed to authoritarian states is because we don't fear what other people will do to us because they're evil. We all know the evil in our own hearts and that we need organizations to limit us from doing evil to each other. And when we fail to have organizations do that, then, yeah, evil happens.
Dr. Hutzinger, last comments?
Well, of course, the education of children is very important, and I think probably more than just a matter of little boys. We saw young women in the Evergrade photographs, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We have a long, hard road ahead of us. We don't need to reach everyone. We just need to reach enough people, and I believe that we can.
And Kevin?
You know, I guess there's a lot that we need to do in society in terms of moral education and dialogue around these issues. I do think that it just has to be said that in this instance, we went into a war in Iraq without really a sufficient moral justification. We have a school of foreign policy thinking that says that morality doesn't really have any part of our foreign policy. And I think at the national level, that's what we've got to kind of engage. We've got to say, no, you know, we need to conduct a foreign policy that promotes democracy by example, that doesn't use military power in a way that is contradictory to the values and ideals that we hold. Engaging in torture is one example of a contradiction with the kind of values and ideals we hold, but it's not the only one our nation's engaged in. And so being a defender of human rights while continuing to defend our country in principled ways is, I think, the direction we've got to go.
I want to thank our guest this morning, Kevin Finney of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. They are sponsoring the Interfaith Forum on the Ethics of Torture and Human Rights. And for more information, you may contact them at www.emoregon.org. And Dr. George Hunsinger, a professor at Princeton Theological Seminary, who will be a keynote speaker at the Interfaith Forum on the Ethics of Torture and Human Rights, and Dr. Darius Rajali, author of Torture and Democracy, so professor here at Reed College, and I can't say enough thanks for that work that you have done, and it's monumental, and I think it's helpful for all of us.
Yeah, well, thank you for inviting me.
And thank you, guests, for joining us. Thank you for listening. Let me remind those of you who are listening, that upcoming here at 9 o'clock at the Omo Variety Hour features an interview with musician Kate Reed. We also hear from Adelina Anthony on Indigenous Chicana Lesbian Multidisciplinary Artist. I said that. The movie Moles review a lesbian spy spoof and satire called DEBS, plus an interview with Women History and Feminist Studies Professor Estelle Freeman. At 10 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman interviews Dr. Jennifer Wider, the author of the New Mom Survival Guide. At 10:30, it's Monday on the Environment. At 11, it's Democracy Now! The Senate is expected to vote on a controversial measure to amend the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act tomorrow. We will hear from Mark Klein, a longtime technician with AT&T, who leaked internal documents that revealed the company had set up a secret room in the San Francisco office to give the NSA access to the fiber optic internet cable. Also on Democracy Now!, Palestinian journalist Mohammed Omer describes being physically and psychologically abused by Israeli security officials in June. Conscientious objector in Iraq war veteran Joshua Key reacts to Canada federal court ruling that the Immigration and Refugee Board should reconsider his asylum claim. And tune in tonight at 10 p.m. where the Talk on Earth presents Portland writer Ursula Le Guin, who reads and talks about her newest book, Lavinia, with Portland poet, writer, and KBOO programmer Jay Thaimaya. All of this here on KBOO-FM. Again, this has been More Talk Radio. I'd like to thank our guests this morning, Kevin Finney, Dr. George Hunsinger, and Dr. Darius Rajali. Thank you and have a great morning.